Well, it's the end of the year, and I'd like to say happy holidays to all of the Twilight Riot. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through a year in review and talk about some of the best episodes that the Twilight gang has come together and found out. We've got things like The Wisp of President, we have Stalkerware, we have Hack in a Box, and we have Bitnami. Well, you know, you'll just have to stay tuned because we have the best of Twilight coming up next.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This Week Enterprise Tech, episode 373 for Friday, December 27th, 2019. The best of 2019. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean offers the simplest, most developer-friendly cloud platform that scales as you grow. Get started today for free with a free $50 credit at do.co/twit. Welcome to Twilight This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca. Happy holidays to you all from the Twilight family. We had a fantastic year, amazing content, fantastic guests, unbelievable co-hosts to drive it all. We wanted to give you a chance to catch up with some of the best of stories, guests, and banter from 2019. To actually start it all off, you actually might have missed some of the great blips that we had, so we'll go get started with those first.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. The U.S. Department of Justice has unsealed espionage-related charges against a former U.S. Air Force service member who helped Iranian hackers target her former colleagues. An arrest warrant was issued for Monica Witt, and indictments were announced for four Iranian hackers who supposedly carried out the cyber attacks acting on information provided by Witt. One of the four Iranian hackers was also charged in November 2017 with hacking HBO, stealing scripts for unaired episodes of Season 6 of Game of Thrones, and later attempting to extort HBO execs for $6 million. He's believed to be a member of the Charming Kitten Iranian cyber espionage unit and a close collaborator with the country's main intelligence service. Witt, who defected to Iran in 2013, is a former U.S. Air Force counterintelligence special agent and specialized in Middle East operations. The DOJ claims that she began working with Iranian hacking units after attending a conference there in 2012, and she worked to craft and fine-tune cyber operations against her former Air Force colleagues, including spear phishing campaigns, malware infections, and social media-based operations by registering an imposter Facebook account in the name of a former colleague and successfully befriending other special agents. The collaboration with Iranian hackers is made much worse because she not only had high-level security clearance, but also field duty experience, and this helped Iranian intelligence gain better insight into how U.S. operations are conducted both internally and overseas.
So it wouldn't be a week of Twilight without calling out a security attack or data breach. Now, this week, a large Michigan-based healthcare and financial processing provider has called out as having a previous data breach. Now, it seems their breach and attack is hitting two birds with one stone, both healthcare and financial data. Now, the Wolverine Solutions Group, or WSG, says that they have discovered that its systems suffered a security breach on September 25th of 2018. Now, you may be wondering how the network was breached. Well, malware from an unknown origin infected several critical path machines and encrypted a large number of the firm's records, preventing them from accessing the content. Now, it took WSG and an outsourced security firm 40 days to recover from the ransom attack after their initial detection. Now, it's not clear how long the breach and cleanup happened that WSG started to notify their customers, but they spent a greater part of December, January, and February sending out notifications to affected individuals. Now, here's the good news. The security firm investigating the breach found that no data at any time was actually exfiltrated from the network during that ransomware attack. Now, this may be a good topic for our guest and panel later, but it seems more and more organizations need to look to data-centric security, security service providers, and moreover, security and information event management systems to help mitigate their risks of running into such attacks in the future. Stay tuned for more on that in a bit.
A crackdown on creepware. Since I spend a lot of time thinking about and working with Wi-Fi, you can assume that I have at least an eighth grade understanding of physics. I really won't claim more than that. And yet I'm confident that any grand unifying theory that comes to fruition is going to include a healthy dose of the law of unintended consequences. I mention this because, like many of you, when apps started showing up like Find My iPhone, Find My Friends, Find My Family, Find My Spouse, I celebrated the progress of technology and how it can be used to make our lives easier. Of course, this was before I understood that there are two kinds of people, and the other kind realized how easy it is to exploit these kinds of apps. And some of those people are creeps. An excellent article in Wired this week details efforts against what has been dubbed stalkerware. Eva Galperin, the director of cybersecurity at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, and on Twitter known as @EvaSide, is the face of these efforts, and she outlines how an entire industry has grown up around spouse or stalkerware, and how it is a, quote, deeply underestimated scourge of digital privacy, and further described it as the small end of a very large, terrifying wedge. Since the predators in these cases often have immediate and intimate access to victims' devices, none of the usual defenses against hacking are of any help. Galperin laid out demands at the Kaspersky Security Analyst Summit in Singapore, including telling the antivirus industry to take the threat of stalkerware seriously, and Apple to take measures to protect iPhone users from stalkerware. The ask of Apple is particularly important since not only do they not allow antivirus apps into their app store, many of the built-in features of iOS are the exploits themselves. She's also calling on the legal community to prosecute executives of stalkerware-selling companies on hacking charges. I wanted to end this blip with a reminder of the National Domestic Abuse Hotline at www.thehotline.org. Ironically, a visit to that site immediately produces a safety alert pop-up that warns visitors that their computer use can be monitored and there is no way to completely eliminate that risk. Enough said.
Well, folks, it's that time of the show. We can jump into the bites. We have some really great news stories for this week to have a little bit of a discussion on. And now, as you hear each and every week on the show, we talk about data breaches, cyber attacks, privacy issues. Now, organizations know that they are going to hit these things quite often, and it's inevitable, right? Now, to prepare for that and to produce, they basically produce expensive data migration plans, securing data. They want to make sure they're alerting the issues and ensure that they really have the right systems in place. But what they also do is they want to make sure that they're covered, just in case there isn't a breach or attack. Well, this story that we're talking about today calls out a well-known food brand called Mondelez Company, which is actually the owner of a dozen food companies like Cadbury Chocolate and Philadelphia Cream Cheese. Now, this company was struck by the NotPetya cyberstrike in 2017. And their business was put to halt, causing them to lose more than $100 million. Now, what made them feel better about the whole ordeal? Well, they were insured, right? That must make them feel better. That's right, good old liability insurance. But when they tried to exercise it, they were blocked by the insurance company, who used a loophole in their clause, saying that they are exercising their war exclusion protocol or clause. I'm sorry, which protects the insurer from being put up with costs related to the damage from war. Now, that's right, they were collateral damage in war. In this case, cyber war. Now, was the insurance company in the right? Now, NotPetya did cause more than $700 million damage worldwide that we know about. Now, how do they classify this as an act of war? Well, according to them, in a statement in 2018, the White House actually described NotPetya as part of the Kremlin's ongoing effort to destabilize Ukraine, and it said it had demonstrated ever more clearly Russia's involvement in the ongoing conflict. So that's kind of how they got around it, and they're bringing it to court. Now there's a suit on it. Now I want to actually throw it to you guys. I want to start with you, Kurt. What do you guys think? Was this really an act of war? Can they really classify it like this? Is it really a way for them to get out of this type of insurance?
Well, can they classify it like this? They can certainly try. As in so many of these things, I suspect that the next step will be the ceremonial throwing of lawyers at one another. but I think that what we have is one of those cases where we find out that words matter. You know, as has been pointed out, previous administrations went to great pains not to describe cyber attacks as being any part of a cyber war. And they went to great pains to paint it in non-military and non-warlike terms. That has not been the case in the last couple of years. And as we've seen the rhetoric ratchet up, insurance companies and others are looking at that rhetoric and seeing what legal impact it could have. So I think this is one of those cases where the urge to justify actions on a political basis are going to have some significant economic ramifications for companies who feel like they should be protected from these things.
Chibert, I want to throw this to you. What do you think? I mean, do you think that this is something that insurance companies should be able to do? Hey, if you're paying for cyber coverage in this case, a lot of them are really kind of narrowly written to kind of relate to customer data loss, and some of them just provide like credit check or cover legal bills, but they don't really kind of recover costs. Should they be able to get out of it by saying, hey, this was war, this is war? I mean, they can basically classify that in anyways.
Well, I don't have a problem with the War Exclusion Act piece itself. You know, insurance and thing, you know, insurance coverage is not a mutual destruction pact. So if we go back to the Blitz in London, insurance companies, Lloyd's of London actually, was unable to fulfill their, you know, fiduciary duties to provide rebuilding money for every case during the Blitz because they had an official act of war. You know, Great Britain was at war with the Axis powers. The problem I have with this is there has been no official act of war. I definitely agree with the previous administration on staying away from using war terms. I'm not real happy with this current administration on pulling the trigger on that and actually using it. Here's a comment from Jake Alcott, the vice president of BitSight Technologies. We still don't have a clear idea of what cyber warfare actually looks like. That is one of the struggles in this case. No one has said that this was an all-out cyber war by Russia or China or North Korea or whatever. This is not – the world is changing, and the insurance company – in this case, I'm going to actually name and shame Zurich Insurance, looked for a loophole, and they decided, no, we're not going to go bankrupt, because if we cover this company for that $100 million, what's to prevent others? I don't think it was right. I don't blame them for not falling on a grenade, so to speak. but I think there's going to need to be some middle ground. Cyber insurance needs to be payable, but cyber insurance isn't a mutual destruction pact.
Right. I think that brings me to the next question. I'll throw this to Curtis. Curtis, what do you think? There's a lot of cyber. If I go search online right now, I can find a bunch of companies that are offering cyber insurance. Does this kind of deem them useless in the future? I mean, obviously, they all have probably similar clauses. Should companies really be leaning on this at all for just protection?
Well, I think that companies must have cyber insurance. I think that in today's atmosphere, if they had any kind of incident, did not have the cyber insurance, they would face massive shareholder revolt and shareholder lawsuits. But I think that what we need to do, and I think what this will begin, is a series of negotiations about what precisely cyber warfare looks like. As Brian says, we don't know right now. We have some ideas. Does the mere participation of a group associated with a nation state mean that it is warfare? That's where we sort of boil things down. And we don't know yet. Courts are going to weigh in, international courts, International insurance law is a dramatic and complex thing. So this is not going to be solved anytime soon. What I do think we're going to need to do is watch the way words are used, because this is one of those great illustrations. Like I said, words matter, and the use of one word over another has consequences in the real world, some of which can cost real money.
Hack in the Box. This is a story that marries the modern maker movement with the creativity of Churchill's toy shop from World War II. If this story has a hero, it's Adafruit. We've all heard of war dialing and war driving, and at least some of us have cringed at the terms war cycling, war jogging, and even war droning. Well, now we have war shipping. Penetration testers will go to great lengths to demonstrate the weaknesses in a client's security posture in order to mitigate them before an actual bad actor takes advantage. And often these make for some of the most compelling briefings at security conferences. But IBM's X-Force Red Team recently showed they know how to work smarter, not harder, and in fact, never had to leave home to get in the door at targeted sites. And the targets weren't even aware they were exposed until they got the bad news. And in true DEF CON fashion, where the point of some of the talks seemed to be a variation of Name That Tune, where the speaker shows how he's doing the same thing others are doing with a $200 off-the-shelf toy, but they're doing it with a $6 Arduino and three Legos, this team showed how for under $100 and some compact hardware, they can turn a shipped package into a Trojan horse for attacks. So we've seen drop boxes before, and these are covert drop boxes that can take the form of device chargers, Wi-Fi routers, and even power strips. Heck, the original warshipping attack was literally the Trojan horse. However, the X-Force Red Team showed that how by using a Raspberry Pi 0W, a small battery, and a cellular modem, they assembled a mobile attack platform that neatly fit within a cardboard spacer, dropped into a shipping box, or embedded in objects such as a stuffed animal or a plaque. That's right. They've weaponized cardboard. Now you can just let a shipping company do the work for you. IBM X-Force Red Global Managing Partner Charles Henderson noted that, you know, you can ship cell phones and things like that, but those tend to look suspicious. So what's cool about this is that it's in the wall of the box. It can easily be built into the cardboard. And so now you can send maybe a plaque to the new Chief Information Security Officer of the Year, and if you put a $13 solar charger panel on the plaque, this makes a permanent fixture in a CISO's office. So this turned out to be a pen test that was wildly successful. And like all pen tests, of course, they had complete permission from the company that they were doing this against. But every single one of these cardboard Trojan horses was welcomed in with open arms. And what's more concerning is that they were actually able to get one of the boxes into a company's secure research center. So this is a place where no cell phones are allowed. They had a rig that was able to store data on an SD card until they dumped the box. And once the box was outside the secure area where the RF shielding was gone, they could then exfil the data back in. So this can be a little bit alarming. And there's some other details that I want to go into, but I'd like to flip this over to my co-hosts, because I'm laughing about this because it's a combination of what next or what do we have to do to win sort of thing. Curtis, I want to ask you, we were just in the ad, we were just talking about default passwords, weak passwords, reused passwords. We're still not even breaking even on that battle. The amount of traffic that we see on the Black Hat network that's sent in clear text every year is purely depressing. What is it now that we have to worry about the Trojan box? What is it that you think InfoSec people are going to need to do to prepare their customers, their clients, or, you know, just train their users to keep them a little bit better prepared?
Well, you know, I, at DEF CON, went to a presentation from the head of security for the Democratic National Committee. And one of the things that he said was that they're treating everything in security as an IT security problem. And I think that what we're going to be seeing is more and more of the physical security folks at companies doing exactly that, treating everything as IT security. I mean, in this case, we have something that could be arriving at the mailroom. Nothing about computers at all, apparently. But suddenly, it's not a physical security issue where a couple of years ago you might have been looking for, you know, white powder or some sort of explosive device. But it's a cybersecurity problem. So I think we're getting to the point of wanting to treat pretty much anything that comes in the door as suspicious until proven innocent. And for a lot of companies, that's going to mean doing much more rigorous inspection by people who aren't trained to do it than ever before.
Right. So you're talking about looking at the receptionist and trying to figure out how to – she already has to worry about tailgaters and things like that. Now she has to be worried about a box being dropped off and whether that actually has technology in there. So do we need to – I'm going to throw this one to you, Lou. Do we need to start including not x-ray machines, but maybe some kind of devices that can scan incoming packages to detect tech-enabled devices? And how practical is that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how practical. I mean, you see a lot of these international packages. They go through x-ray. They're allowed to open them, these types of things when they detect specific things, especially electronics or batteries or that kind of thing. Perishables. I don't think that's scalable, though. I don't think that that's a model that we can follow without having to hire, like Amazon's doing, their own kind of shipping company and their own additional people to support that. So I just don't think the infrastructure can support it. But another thing, too, is, you know, I've heard of some local organizations, local cities, actually going into the process of thinking, okay, well, if we even detect something that's got a battery or actually is on, it actually detects a signature, electronic signature coming from it. They don't want things that are being shipped that actually are capable of being turned on or have batteries actually installed in them. And so they go through a more rigorous process to determine if where they've been shipped from and that kind of thing. I don't even know if that's even scalable. So, you know, this is a hard problem. I mean, basically, hackers are finding little intricacies within our processes today that we don't. There's no checks and balances there, and that will continue to happen, especially ones like this, which is really, really hard to fix. So, I actually don't have an answer for you.
I always say I'm waiting for the smarter people to answer some of these questions that are coming up. So one of the things that was interesting about this actual the solution that they had put together, and they're not releasing a lot of the details for obvious reasons. They're pen testers. They're not trying to spread the capability. But they custom wrote the code to make it as low powered using as possible to extend the life of this this device. But they also had it so that they could talk to it at set times so they could check to see where it was. And so with the way shipping companies are, you can fairly accurately predict where in transit this box is. And then, of course, with GPS coordinates, you can determine where it has arrived. One of the things that they got sort of as a bonus, if you will, is that because it was scanning on the Wi-Fi side, it was actually doing a pen test of everything that it was seeing in transit. So this included the Wi-Fi on the airplanes, the rigs as the trucks were moving across the country for the delivery area. And so that part was actually pretty interesting. Learning more about the Adafruit, this is the whole story is actually really interesting. And if, for those of you who weren't able to see the presentation at Black Hat. The PDF of it will be available, I don't know, in 2 to 8 weeks, depending on how long they upload that. But I have one more question, and I'm going to throw this one back to Curtis, because you, or I don't know if you got to see that presentation, but you certainly were there. One of the advantages, or one of the parts of the attack of this, was that it was doing old-fashioned Wi-Fi sniffing. So they were turning it on and then just capturing the packets, getting the hash of the pre-shared key, and then exfiltrating it so that the system, the more robust system back at home base, could do the cracking, and then from that do sideways attacks. So I I'm going to get to my question in a second, but this seems to be, the fairly easy answer to that is enterprise level encryption and not just a pre-shared key. How much of this is just sort of the interesting thing du jour and is detracting from attention for like the real honest to God basic things that we need to be doing, like not resharing keys or not reusing passwords, putting in .1x encryption, making sure that your servers are patched, that kind of thing. How much of this is just, wow, it's got a sexy name?
Well, there's going to be a piece of this that plays to our fascination with the latest shiny object. And, you know, I'll admit, I'm a journalist. I depend on the latest shiny object to give me something to write about and keep me gainfully employed. So there is a piece of that. Going back and constantly saying you've got to update your level of encryption, you've got to use the latest protocols rather than old, known, broken protocols. You know, the basic blocking and tackling. It's up there with all of the people in the healthcare field who say, you know, you really need to get a decent night's sleep. You need to eat well. You need to move around. And we would much rather focus on the latest fad diet or newest miracle medal we can wear on a pinky ring or something like that to keep us healthy. The fact is, though, that this does, for some number of situations, represent a very real, fairly difficult to guard against threat vector. And so it can't be just blithely passed off. As these systems get smaller and cheaper, it's going to be much easier to not only grab shared keys, but to put things like, you know, simple capture and fuzzing technology on one of these very, very small processors. And if you don't have to go through the Wi-Fi, if you have instead, say, a very simple cell network transceiver, you can do all kinds of things. And those now are very small. These are very compact. And they represent a very real threat. So on the one hand, the greatest volume of threats is going to come through the same sort of threat vectors that we've seen for the past decade. And organizations need to do the same very basic things to protect against them. On the other hand, just because those traditional threat vectors haven't gone away doesn't mean we can ignore the latest shiny object.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the next bite, because actually this one's a little bit more interesting. It's a little about how CISOs are actually mentally having mental problems. Is that right, Curtis?
Absolutely, and a surprising number. Now all of us have known CISOs where we would come out of a meeting and go, they're not quite right in the head. But that's not what this is talking about. With a recent study, a quarter of CISOs suffer from mental and health disorders as a result of the work pressures they're experiencing. Now, the things that contribute to the strain are concerns about job security, inadequate budget and resources, and a continued lack of support from the board and upper management. And this is tied to other surveys that I've seen that point out the fact that one of the bars to a good security posture, one of the things that stands between a CISO and feeling comfortable about his or her organization's ability to respond to an attack is this lack of resources, both human resources and financial resources, to invest in technology. This survey, which was conducted by Nominet, a domain name registry service, found that 91% of the responders admitted to experiencing high to moderate stress. 26%, a little over a quarter, said the stress was impacting them mentally and physically. And a very troubling 17% admitted to turning to alcohol and medication, both licit and illicit, to deal with the stress. So 40-hour work weeks are not things that exist among CISOs. 22%, so over a fifth, said that they are available on a round-the-clock basis. Now, think about this. This is someone with a C-level title who says that they have to essentially have a pager on so that they can be available 24/7. 9 out of 10 of those based in the U.S. said they don't take a break from work that lasts 2 weeks or more. They just can't do it. So what do we need to do about this? We know that there is a top management disconnect. The other individuals in the C-suite and the board of directors seem to have no appreciation for the kind of stresses that the CISOs are feeling. They're looking at massive data sets that have all kinds of points of entry. They're looking at growing cloud application frameworks that have all kinds of connectors and places where a hacker can gain entry. So I'm curious with both my co-hosts, and Lou, I'm going to start with you. Does this match up with what you have seen in the people you deal with at the corporate level?
Yeah, I think, I mean, do I see people having issues? Yeah, I mean, obviously there's definitely a scenario where, you know, cloud services and organizations that are exposed to the internet, especially that service organizations, they have these jobs where they have to have rotations, call rotations, and ensure that they have or they're connected 24/7, especially for those big customers out there. And I think that, you know, these data centers, these NOC locations, all of these potential locations have to be able to handle these types of things. And sometimes they're looking for escalation. So you have a big organization like a bank that comes in and says, I'm having a problem, and they're dealing with whether it's support engineers or escalation engineers or just network engineers. They want to talk all the way up the chain. They want to know that they're getting supported by a representative that's going to get them their stuff fixed fast. And so that's why these people are actually on call all the time, and they have to be, because they have to represent their service, their organization. And so I can honestly say that it does get tiring after a while. I've worked in services in the past where you were on call 24/7, and it does not stop. Like, there are things going wrong and you're constantly fixing things. That's the whole idea between continuous integration and deployment. You're constantly fixing and deploying things and making sure that you kind of solidify your service. So I can honestly say that there's a lot of stress and pressure on these individuals. So I'm not too surprised that people are actually, you know, running into problems and issues and need help. And I can say that, you know, this is just maybe a type of the part of the actual industry that might need some more help from different software and different technology to help with this stress and also help relieve some of that stress. What that technology is, I don't know. But hopefully in the future, we'll see better stuff.
Well, I'm going to come back to you with a follow-up question in just a moment. But before I do, I want to turn to Heather. There's no doubt that the CISOs are under tremendous stress. But in today's business environment, where we've got globalization going on, you've got rising costs of materials, fickle customers, all kinds of things, do you get the sense that CISOs are under more pressure than the other people who have C in the title? Or do you think that the CISOs are just better at complaining about it?
No, I think that they actually, you know, and it may be just that it's what we see. And so we have more of a empathy for them. But let's just go with an average news day. You turn the news on, the chances of you seeing a discussion about yet another breach or another vulnerability being discussed are not bad. And is there any other C-level guy or girl that's going to turn the news on a semi-regular basis and see something that directly impacts their day, their week, their month, their quarter, right there on CNN? I don't, maybe there's some really exciting accounting news that I've missed, but I think that the CISO guys really are under constant fire. I was laughing because Lou said, I don't know what that technology is going to look like, but we need something to get, you know, to help. And my first thought was, and then it will have a vulnerability or a breach. So it's almost a self-replicating a problem. I would like to add one other thing, because obviously I am not somebody who has ever aspired or will aspire to a C-level position, but I'm in a unique situation of I go to these conferences. If you go to a trade show, I don't know that either of you have ever had the experience of walking in a show floor and not being able to get the attention of somebody besides, if you'll excuse the terminology, a booth babe. If you wanted to talk to the engineer or somebody serious at the booth, I will bet you that not only do you not have a problem with it, that you actually have trouble getting past them because they all want to talk to you. I am wearing an invisibility cloak. I sometimes refer to them as mammary glands, but I don't know what it is. But when I walk through a trade show, I cannot get anyone to pay any attention to me or answer a question. So last year, I changed my title and I put down CISO to see if that maybe would get a little bit more attention. It didn't, but it got me an incredible amount of spam. Everybody who scanned them. So I can tell you that these guys, my inbox for the next 6 months exploded with everybody wanting to get my attention about everything. So just dealing with their daily email must be incredibly stressful.
Well, you know, that invisibility cloak is something that I know that Chibert is listening, and I think there is a worthwhile episode of Twiet down the line where we look at some of those issues. But before we get to that very critical topic, I want to wrap up with this one. And Lou, I want to get back to you, because I know that I have taken management training classes at various times where they say things like, if you have an employee who is consistently working more than 40 hours a week, then you've either got a problem with the employee or you have a problem with the job. You should be able to define a job that can be done in 40 hours a week and find the individual to go into it. So, question to you is, with all of this talk about stress, with all of the hours, with all of the everything else, should we be providing more support to these CISOs, or is it time to look at fundamentally redefining the job to make it possible without harming the individual who holds the title?
Yeah, that's a great question. I honestly think that there's two parts to it. One is obviously the job definition might not need to be changed. I think that obviously, you know, their individual requirements of the job is fine. I think the biggest part is because they're decision makers, they're ones that run, you know, the entire organization. But I think what needs to change is potentially the processes, the workflows. And like you said, anytime you have a problem with somebody who's spending more time in working longer hours, there's usually a problem in the process and there's usually a problem in the system. And that's where I think leadership should get to work. I think they should get to work and understand, okay, well, obviously leadership is running into a problem of working overtime. This obviously is going to trickle down to the rest of the organization. You're going to have an unhappy organization. How can we model it so that it doesn't work that way anymore? And I think that's where it's different for every organization. I'm not going to pretend to know for every one of them, but I have seen shifts and pivots in organizations in order to alter the way things are being done. Like I was saying, we used to do rotations. We used to add in more systems to use use more machine learning and AI to determine issues faster or even before customers ran into them. I've seen better logging, better tracing, more alerts, using systems to handle these types of things and be able to route them correctly, not just to the leadership. So I think that these are things that organizations should definitely take better look at. Even before you have a problem with people running into longer hours. But in the same sense, to answer your question, I definitely think that it's time to not necessarily redefine the job title or the job requirement, but to redefine the process. Now, as you saw, those were some fantastic bites from this year. Next up is my favorite part of the show, where we get to actually bring in and show you all the amazing guests that we had during this year. But before we do that, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is DigitalOcean. Now, as a developer, I can tell you the ability to experiment with your apps on and build your apps on a truly hosted environment is sometimes hard. Now, DigitalOcean removes the impedance and gets rid of the complexity of cloud deployments and hosting. They make it easier than ever to deploy your applications and code and store things in the cloud without all the steps in between. I also love all the things, all the names they give things, starting with DigitalOcean's Droplets, which are actually super scalable virtual machines that you can add storage, security, monitoring capabilities with just one click of a button. In fact, they also have really great one-click deployments that make it easy for you to bootstrap your project. You want a specific distribution of Linux? Well, one-click deploy Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, and more. You want to deploy a one-click application or application stack? Well, add Docker, LAMP, MongoDB, Node.js, MySQL, and more with just one click. Not only is it easy to deploy, it's easy to manage as well. You have VM snapshots, which are actually super simple ways to take and manage your applications. For me, it really just gives me that peace of mind, or that last known good state is always just one click away. Plus, team management, unified collaborations helps you kind of manage your team and your scale and actually scale your infrastructure and apps. You need more security for your infrastructure? Well, one click, add a cloud firewall for your droplet groups. Get this, cloud firewalls are free. And don't let that free tag actually fool you. These things are production-ready firewalls for free. Now, DigitalOcean is trusted by over 1 million developers that make it simple to launch in the cloud and scale up as you grow. Whether you're running on one virtual machine or 10,000 virtual machines, spin up a virtual machine in just 60 seconds or less. Standard, general purpose, or CPU optimized configurations provide flexibility to build, test, and grow your application. The DigitalOcean has over 2,000 open source tutorials to actually help you stay up to date on the latest open source software, languages, and frameworks. Not only that, but you can also modernize your cloud infrastructure as well with DigitalOcean's marketplace. They have a diverse catalog of over 100 pre-configured one-click apps like CloudBees, Docker, GitLab, Node.js, Ruby on Rails, LAMP, and many more. Now, to meet the demands of the market, DigitalOcean follows that great model of predictable pricing. Always know that what you're actually going to pay with monthly caps and flat pricing across all data centers. No more complexity when it comes to understanding your future bills or paying your current ones. If you're like me, you love to write scripts and manage things, right? Well, DigitalOcean has you covered as well. As an API guy, I can tell you that you actually have to do great things with APIs. You can actually just use standard HTTP requests, and that's the same with DigitalOcean. They actually help you deploy and manage thousands of droplets and resources in a simple, programmatic way. DigitalOcean offers simple, predictable pricing. Always know what you're going to pay with flat, industry-leading pricing structures. And in fact, they offer a ton of other reasons why you should choose DigitalOcean at no additional cost. You'll get 24/7, 365 world-class support. Plus, you can be informed at all times with monitoring and alerts. They have 99.99% SLA uptime. In fact, they also offer team accounts for easier collab. Tons of controls like full DNS management, and they're geolocatable 12 global data centers. If you ask me, DigitalOcean has you covered across the board. Now, there's no reason why you shouldn't go right now and try DigitalOcean, especially to support us here on TWIT. Go to do.co/twit. Even if you think you might have a project in the future, go out and try right now. Tons of businesses already are using DigitalOcean, including some of the world's fastest growing startups rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. DigitalOcean is on a mission to simplify cloud computing so developers and their teams can spend more time building software that changes the world. Go to do.co/twit today to sign up and receive a $50 credit. That's do.co/twit for a free $50 credit. DigitalOcean, designed for developers, built for businesses. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show, where we actually get to bring in and show you some of the great guests that we had during this year. And to do that, I'm gonna actually throw it over to Cheebert for all the intros. Cheebert.
You know, our favorite part of the show has always been the interviews with guests laying down some great enterprise knowledge for the Twiat Riot. What we have here is just a great selection of the best interviews we thought were in 2019. And you know what? We'd love to hear your show ideas. Drop us a line at twiat@twit.tv. That way it'll hit all the hosts. And, you know, we've had some great suggestions. We'd love to hear yours. Happy holidays.
Can you maybe just tell us a little bit, give us a primer of what WISP is and what you're trying to do?
Sure. So WISP is the voice of the fixed wireless industry here in the United States of America. So, you know, you think about, when you're thinking about broadband distribution technologies, you think of fiber, you think of mobile wireless, you think of satellite. One of the distribution technologies that is less well known is fixed wireless. So it kind of functions like a mixture of mobile wireless and satellite, but you know, you can operate with the speeds of fiber depending on the technology. So you have wireless access points up on a tower. You have another a radio on the customer premise equipment that on the customer premise that talks back and forth. That's the technology that our members use. We have about 800 of them, mostly are small rural mom and pop shops who started up, put their life savings on the line or went into credit card debt just because they were frustrated with a lack of good internet service in their community. And then they got themselves some, then their neighbor's neighbor started asking for service, and they grew a business out of that. And those are the folks that we represent. We try to help them out with education. We host a couple of trade shows every year. We help them out with advocacy in D.C. and in state houses across the country, and just providing an opportunity for folks to get together and to learn from each other and help each other out as they try to provide better service to their customers.
Fantastic. So you kind of briefly touched on it, and there are obviously some challenges here, especially with some of the commissions that are out there right now. They're kind of driving policy. What are you seeing the major challenges for WISP right now?
Yeah, so every couple of years, someone will do a survey of folks in our industry, and the two biggest challenges tend to come out always as access to spectrum and access to capital. And the former is something that we try to help a lot with. Historically, the way that spectrum policy has been done in the United States tends to work for a business model of mobile wireless. So, and even as a subset of that, the largest national players. So you think if you're thinking about, licensed spectrum tends to be auctioned off in giant geographic areas. So, makes sense for someone who's Wall Street funded, who's looking for a nationwide footprint. Doesn't make sense for someone who has, 500 subscribers in rural Nebraska to acquire something like that. So a lot of our members will get started on unlicensed spectrum. So same spectrum that's used for Wi-Fi. But the downside there is you don't have any sort of interference protection. But we tend to work pretty well together with the folks on the Wi-Fi side of the house and, in advocating for better and more unlicensed spectrum.
Now, what are we talking about? Like how many like fixed access providers are there today in basically the whole United States?
Sure. So we estimate there's somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000. Most of them are really small, which is why none of them are really household names. Serve somewhere between 4 and 6 million Americans with broadband service, both on the residential and the enterprise side.
Got it. Now, you touched a little bit about on some of the challenges they have. What are fixed wireless providers? Are they driving their adoption based off of latest technology? You touched a little bit on that. Is maybe 5G driving this? Or is there other things driving it as well?
Yeah, so a lot of our folks have been in operation for, the longest operator probably has been in business for about 30 years, and they were using, Motorola Canopy gear back in the day. But radio technology has come a long way in the past decade or so, so that folks are able to offer, speeds of, 100 megabits over a fixed wireless link for, mass market residential connections, and then gigabit plus for enterprise. So, on the enterprise side, what a number of our members will see is they'll start out, with the business as the redundant failover connection, and then they'll be asked to be the primary connection in sort of an SD-WAN kind of setup.
Makes sense. Well, this is definitely a juicy topic for my co-host, especially for Mo. Mo, I want to throw it over to you. I know you got some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, this is definitely a topic that's near and dear to my heart, since my connection to you guys today is going over my WISP's connection that is rock solid, and I absolutely love it. And before I started this relationship with the WISP that I have now, I did have my only option was satellite. Which obviously Twyatt wasn't going across the satellite. I was actually jury rigging. I have a cellular booster out on my balcony here, and I was tethering to one of my cellular devices. So you talked about the number of rural clients that are on these networks. I'd like people to have an understanding of the length and breadth, the amount of geography that would be rural and is basically relying on these WISPs in order to get any internet short of the satellite.
Yeah, it's a pretty significant swath of land, and it's limited only by the business case and the spectrum access. So, I was driving through, from Spokane to Walla Walla, Washington last month, and, counting farmhouses around along the way and looking both for satellite dishes and for WISP gear on roofs as I was passing it. So the provider that and member that I met up there had a territory of about 150 by 250 miles, and they're a small business with fewer than 30 employees. So they tend to cover a lot of ground, and that's one of the benefits of the technology, right? You don't have to run a wire to a house, and if you have decent spectrum access, you can beam a signal for several miles and still have pretty robust service in order to connect people whose choice is exactly like you said, Mo, either expensive cellular data or heavily throttled and unreliable satellite.
Right. Yeah. And I have so many questions that I'd like to talk with you about. We're absolutely sure. Just going to have you come back.
We'll come back. We'll do it offline, whatever you want.
Okay. No. You're going to have to come back online too. That's for sure. aside from the fact that these are small, and I did like the way you characterize these mom and pop organizations, because the other thing that I think a lot of people don't understand is that they're also operating on razor thin margins. This is just not, nobody's doing this to get rich quick. And I will say this, that for a 3-county area, the only fiber that we have around here involves oatmeal. So I now have in this one little neighborhood off of this one tower, we have better internet access than anybody else in the entire 3-county area, but I actually have better rates now than I did when I lived in the suburbs of Dallas, and I had a fiber connection from AT&T, and that was just 2 years ago. So it's not that you really are getting something that's more as reliable and even in some cases some better connectivity. You talked about the spectrum, access to spectrum, because so the business case is obviously if you build it, they will come and use it. And I characterize internet access like gas molecules. It will expand to fill any container that it's in. So however much you provide, people will find a way to use that connectivity. But what changes in access to spectrum are happening that are going to be able to help these? And you didn't use a number. It's 97% of the land mass of the U.S. that we're talking about.
Yeah. Thanks for filling in that number. But yeah, so a couple of things that we're hoping will come down the pike soon, and this is one thing that the Wi-Fi industry is excited about, and something that we're really excited about too, is it looks like the FCC is going to open up about 1 gigahertz of spectrum in the 6 gigahertz spectrum band. And make it available on an unlicensed basis, both for low power indoor use and a subsection of that for the higher power outdoor use that our members need to be able to provide the longer range fixed wireless service. One other issue that we're hopeful on and we're working on is a piece of spectrum called the C band. So this is 3.7 to 4.2 gigahertz, 500 megahertz of spectrum that's being used by satellite Earth stations to downlink content across the nation. And one of the nice things about fixed wireless is that we can share with these Earth stations. So imagine the country is a giant piece of Swiss cheese with these holes where these Earth stations need to be protected. Mobile wireless doesn't play well with those Earth stations. Fixed wireless can. So there's a huge amount of spectrum that's available that we can potentially take advantage of to provide residential gigabit speed broadband over fixed wireless if that's made available in the right way.
So we know that some of the obvious things that are going on with cybersecurity, but let's start with just kind of the main obvious one. It's cloud adoption, people moving to cloud native. It's the movement from on-premise to the cloud. It's opening some doors to cybersecurity issues and cyber warfare today. Can you maybe bring us through what trends we're seeing as more and more organizations move to the cloud?
Yeah, I think there's a few of them that are a little non-intuitive. So one of them is definitely, cloud itself, not good or bad in security. It's really what you do with it. And the problems we see mostly are during the transition period. So as folks are doing like a lift and shift over to the cloud, that's when a lot of the issues are happening, especially lack of preparedness or using live data in a lot of the sort of initial projects. I think the second one, too, is assuming that there's going to be a lot of the protective measures or protective mechanisms available that you had on premise or in your other kinds of instances that may not be there. For example, controlling the network. So today it's really hard, for example, to get network IPS in your cloud deployments. So you either plan to hunt it down or you go without it. So
might make sense. Now, I think we're seeing a lot of people, obviously organizations, like you said, lift and shift, they're moving themselves, they're slowly moving themselves. So it's kind of the data, it's the services, it's the applications. How are organizations getting ready for that? I mean, what are IT pros and operation teams should they be doing, I guess, would be the better question, as they kind of start to move slowly, sometimes fast to the web?
I think the biggest step is kind of plan for not what you're doing today, but what's coming up. Sounds kind of simple, but one of the most troublesome ones is multi-cloud. And I think, being multi-cloud today is the reality that you're going to have more than just one provider or one cloud, cloud service provider. So start to plan your security around that. And sometimes that can be a hard decision because your dev teams who take the first toe into the water are often going to pick the tools and the techniques used from a single cloud provider. But that may not help you if you go from, AWS to Azure. So planning ahead and assuming that you're going to have multiple providers, I think, is the first one.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think one of the interesting things that I was always worried about, especially as different organizations, is like IT pros and operational teams, they're not familiar with this model. They're slowly learning. What is the best way for these types of organizations and teams within the organizations to kind of stay on top of the knowledge and the best practices of securing endpoints and moving data to the cloud?
Yeah, I think it's hands-on is the best one. That, you know, sort of theory and working groups and planning is one thing, but there's nothing better than hands-on, especially for understanding what the security is and just how these things operate and what the interfaces are and what you can see back for reporting and the like. And also, I think taking on what you're good at and outsourcing the stuff you're not. So, for example, there's really good choices out there today for some of the configuration control. So if you're really stressed, you're not an expert in this area, whatever it be, in sort of cloud security, there's lots of help out there, including some who will take care of a lot of those things that are not issues with on-premise, like capping the billing. So those kinds of new kinds of configurations are some of the gotchas that orgs need to start to look at and plan for.
That makes sense. So that kind of segues into my next question. There's a lot of security as services kind of opening the door today where they're saying, hey, we will help you. We will assist you by doing the monitoring and machine learning about your network for you. Is this helping organizations? Is it hurting organizations? What do you think?
Cloud, everything, in fact, in security, I'm a huge fan of getting extra help, especially for non-core things. Much better choices than there used to be today, and real deep expertise, especially with the personnel shortage in security, which is such a real thing that you just can't bring in, a lot of sort of, for example, cloud experts or the like. You just won't find those lying around on the street, looking for work with holding up help wanted signs. So non-core things are great to do that with, and there's much better. There's such a marketplace for that nowadays. But don't go cheapest. Find ones that are suited to you and your budget. But lowest cost compliance, not the best. Find the expertise you need, especially around security. That's something that you don't always want to go super cheap on.
All right, makes sense. Now, what about AI, machine learning? Is this making it easier? Like for instance, systems determining presence of attackers, making sure that they detect incoming data or incoming traffic that's unusual, these types of things. What kind of trends are you seeing there?
Yeah, well, it's certainly people using those words a lot and kind of, AI washing or machine learning washing, things that really aren't, that they're just scripts or the like. But, machine learning's real and there's super value there. Again, if people are in such short supply, low value tasks, things we've seen before in security, use machine learning for that. Even down non-machine learning, even just sort of scripted things, automating it, huge advantage for the low stuff. Leave your people for the much more involved tasks, things where you need people to be involved, get them involved at the things where they take organizational knowledge or a really specific skill set. AI being predictive, we're starting to see that now, gets really interesting both from the defense side and the attack side. But if you're not deep into AI, don't jump there. Start with machine learning first and start to dip your toe in so you can assess the reality of the AI solutions you're looking at, whether that's going to get you in trouble or help you.
Makes sense. Now, a lot of these solutions, they don't actually change the landscape, but actually they might change the landscape. And that meaning, like, for instance, IoT devices or social media attacks or phishing attacks, that types of things, things that services like this can't help. What should be organizations be doing and what kind of attacks are you seeing?
Yeah, so the attack landscape is actually pivoted backwards in a way that we're seeing more involvement of social engineering or, for example. So, as sort of the broad-based kind of, barrage type volumetric attacks, get less exciting. We're seeing attacks now where you can really target individuals or use social engineering or OSINT to get involved. So the biggest one is what we call business email compromise, and that's where you're going after not just spamming an organization with emails to try to get stuff done, but you're going to really craft deeply, an attack on an empowered individual who can do wire transfers, who can move money, who can make decisions on giving you access. That's where the big money is today. So just in the last few days, a local hospital got hit for apparently, several $1 million through, again, business email compromise, like whaling or, advanced spear phishing, whatever you're going to call it. But that's where we've seen a lot of the pivot is really focusing down these attacks on a few individuals. Another one is trying not to get caught. That pivot has changed. So ransomware, is a connecting of the dots closer to the money. So instead of trying to capture, credit card data and sell it, that's a lot of work. Ransomware, that's work too. Instead, let's just use cycles to Bitcoin mine instead. Less chance of getting caught. Security teams are not super experienced at doing consumption analysis or watching for that. So that's where the attacks are pivoting as well to crypto jacking or crypto mining.
Makes sense. I do want to come back to that. Before I do, my co-hosts are chomping at the bit here and behind the scenes are virtually raising their hands looking for ask questions. So I want to throw it over to Curtis first. He has some questions about DevOps.
Yeah, Greg, appreciate hearing, you talk about DevOps and the role of the developer in security. My question, to take it sort of the next step is to look at what containers are doing to security, both in terms of how they're playing with the way companies need to protect a containerized infrastructure. And we're starting to see people talking about containerized security. So can you talk about either of those? I mean, first of all, are containers something that you're having to address the security needs of? And do you see containers playing a role as part of security in the future?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing it today. I spent a large part of this week actually talking about container security with colleagues. It's real. When we speak to, enterprises, often I come up with this, sort of mental picture of these Russian stacking dolls that work out. And, we've been good at sort of, machine security and then, security virtualized, within the OS and then, within the applications and containers, are certainly just one sort of layer, abstracted within or one layer even more discrete with that. There's been a lot of rules around containers that should never contain data themselves, but I think that's an assumption. But I really like what you mentioned about containers themselves being used for security. And definitely, as we look at sort of containers being these things that we can sort of add or subtract so easily to apps, what a great technique for security itself. But definitely, as containers also have a whole vendor landscape around those and a whole, standards landscape, security has to evolve with those if you're going to use containers. So anything you're going to use in tech, especially in virtualized or data centers, you've got to have a security answer for.
But let's start with the Power Platform because you kind of talked about that for a second. Can you kind of give us a quick overview of the different solutions here and what you are trying to solve with them?
Absolutely. So Power Platform is a term that's kind of just barely have been breathed into existence the last few months. It really is talking about three products from Microsoft: Power BI, Power Apps, and Microsoft Flow, each of which are low-code or no-code tools to very easily analyze data in the case of Power BI, very easily develop mobile or web applications in the case of Power Apps, or very easily automate things or integrate things in the case of Microsoft Flow. And the problem we're really trying to solve with the Power Platform is when talking to customers, there's really thousands of different applications that IT or developers want to go create that are specific to that business, but they're not able to keep up with it because it's too expensive or takes too long. But the Power Platform really brings the tools to the end users, the business users, people who could use Office or Dynamics or Salesforce or Slack or whatever it is to actually go create these solutions themselves. So that's kind of the real big transformation we're doing with the Power Platform is empowering the end users in a modern cloud and mobile world.
That's great. Yeah. So I think let's dig in a little bit more. So I think you said, for instance, Flow. I'm full disclosure, I use Flow every day. But what is Flow trying to solve? Like, what is it trying to do? What does it allow a customer to solve in their aspect?
Yep. Yeah. So Flow is all about automating tasks that you do at work that you don't want to be doing manually each and every day. So everybody has things like this. You get an email from a customer, you got to go take the attachment and move it to your CRM. Or when you get a particular message on Slack, you want to go bring it over to a different channel that you use, like maybe inside of Outlook. That's where the rest of your team is. You can do all of that with Flow.
And what's special about it is it has connectors to over 230 systems, from Adobe to Zendesk, Microsoft, and other non-Microsoft products. It makes it very easy to just click and drag and drop things together in that flow designer, which is on the screen right now, to go connect data and events and actions across all these different systems. So what we see our customers tend to do is just, I have just those manual tasks. I want to go make my team or myself more efficient, and you can go take care of that with Microsoft Flow.
Fantastic. Now I've used a lot of these other products before. There's some other ones in the industry, like IFTTT, there's Zapier, and recently there was Zoqua, which actually was acquired by Okta. And they allow for different integrations, not as much as the Flow platform, but they also offer templates and recipes and workflow customizations. Now, what is like Flow trying to do to say, hey, we do more, we allow you to do more, we're a platform more than anything else?
Yeah, so in the case of like, say, Ift or Zapier, Ift very much is more consumer-oriented, very IoT-heavy presence. And we see that not overlapping as much with the Zapier or Microsoft Flow customer base, which are much more focused on automation and efficiencies at work. And in the case of Flow, one of the big focuses for us is we just try to integrate Flow in all the systems you already use. And what we mean by that is we have a Flow bot for Microsoft Teams. We have Flow integration in Excel. We have Flow integration with a bunch of other different systems and services. And kind of the overarching idea there is just you don't always want to go to a different tool or a different context to go create these automations or find the templates. You can just do it right inside of the tools you know and love. So that's a really big focus for us with Flow. And just, yeah, again, that very much a slant towards the business and professional type of tasks that you see in the enterprise.
Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because I do have a bunch of questions for you. So I'll start with Curtis. Curtis, you want to talk a little bit about training wheels?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. You know, I'm a big fan in general of low-code and no-code solutions. I think they allow people, especially out in the business units, to make processes happen automatically without having to go through through the IT department. The problem is that they're able to make some things happen without involving the IT department. And so my question is, what kind of training wheels do you have in place with Flow to keep someone in, say, the marketing department from writing a Flow that takes advantage of existing enterprise applications, does something unexpected, and runs a critical application off the rails accidentally?
Yeah, I think the joke we make is we've made it so easy for everybody to create these things. Now we have to go help them do that in a controlled way. So that's a really big focus for things like Flow. So one of the unique things that Microsoft has in the Power Platform is very powerful governance technologies for admins. So if you're a Power Platform admin, say sitting in IT, you can create data loss prevention policies or even create basically guardrails for your employees. So you can create things like you're not allowed to take data from SAP and post it to Twitter because it's probably not a good thing for you to be doing. And that will be enforced for everybody in your company whenever they go create a Flow. And the whole idea there is we want to make it very, very easy for people to be creative and empowered, but to do it in a way that adheres to the security and the compliance regulations of that particular company. And like financial services companies and insurance companies are two of the biggest segments where we see a ton of traction for the Power Platform. And for them, it's incredibly important that they have that governance built in. Otherwise, it's too easy for sensitive information or internal trade secrets to be leaked externally. So things like data loss prevention, things like the admin center, things like reporting on usage in the company are all tools that we give to the IT department to kind of keep control while at the same time empowering everybody to go create what they want in the business.
Well, folks, we're talking with Eric Brescia, co-founder and COO of Bitnami. Thank you so much for being here. We're talking a little bit about Kubernetes and kind of the adoption of it. We do have some more questions. I want to bring in my co-hosts as well, because they've also had some questions about it. And then we kind of want to talk about a little bit about the Linux Foundation, as well as your venture as well that you've been kind of involved with. But I think real quick, I do want to get your thoughts on, so we've seen where Kubernetes has been. We've seen how quickly it's been adopted. Where do you think it's going? Where do you think it will evolve to, and how will it help those organizations evolve as well?
You know, for all the talk about Kubernetes, it still is really very early days. I think what we're going to see over time is companies being able to operate their infrastructure much more effectively and efficiently as new tools are developed to manage Kubernetes. I mean, there's still, if you look, there's, you know, 100 different Kubernetes networking tools and monitoring tools and everything else. And I think over time, as the industry matures, we'll see some consolidation and some clear winners emerge. And we'll see it get a lot easier to adopt Kubernetes. And we're working on some projects at Bitnami to help kind of further that goal as well.
Now, we always ask guests because we kind of constantly have a sway between whether organizations should move between FaaS or functions as a service, VMs or containers. Like, what would you be telling people on how they should decide and where they go first and where they move?
I mean, the first question I always ask is, you know, what's your goal? What are you optimizing for? And what does the app do? Because it really does matter, right? Like some applications probably will never be fully containerized because it just doesn't make sense based on how the application was written. Maybe over time it'll get replaced with something that's developed to be truly cloud native, but some things just aren't worth refactoring. We don't see a ton of functions as a service yet, but I know it's certainly being adopted quite a bit for different specific use cases. We see a lot more right now in stuff just moving to Kubernetes. One of the interesting things that comes up a lot too when you talk about functions as a service is lock-in, right? And for a lot of enterprise companies, they get nervous about going too deep on a particular cloud vendor and architecting their applications to be too dependent on specific cloud vendor services. And obviously a lot of them have functions as a service offerings as well as Kubernetes as a service offerings. So as with anything, I think it's a trade-off too, like how much efficiency and automation do you want to get and how much are you willing to offload to another provider versus, you know, how much lock-in are you willing to accept and control are you willing to give up in order to get any kind of efficiency benefit. So it really does depend, and it's not usually just a tech problem. You know, from my perspective, it's also a business problem, and like, what are you trying to solve for?
Makes sense. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in. I think to you first, Jeebert.
So Kurt and I wrote a book on cloud computing, and one of the predictions that we made in that book was that somewhere along the line, we're going to start seeing science fiction become science fact. And I want you and I to compare crystal balls here. Are we going to someday get to the point where a customer can take their containerized applications and start shopping it around to different cloud providers? Are we there yet, or are we creeping up on that goal?
I would say we're definitely not there yet, except in maybe very specific cases. Kubernetes does give you a lot more portability, but you do see each cloud vendor has its own solutions for networking, monitoring, all of these other things that you still need to take into account. And in fact, we developed something called the Bitnami Kubernetes Production Runtime, which is an open source project that kind of deploys a suite of best of breed tools in your Kubernetes cluster to try to give people a way to standardize the way that they're deploying applications across any different Kubernetes platform that they're running on. But right now, if you're not using something like that, you're probably using the different tools and configurations that you need for each cloud platform. So I would say that extreme portability is not really there yet, unless you're using systems that have already been like tied together to be portable. Of course, over time, I do think we'll get closer and closer to that. And where we see the cloud vendors trying to differentiate is both in how they build out and manage their relationships with customers. I mean, certainly some vendors are known to be more supportive of their customers and engage more deeply than others. And they're all customers, so I'm not going to go and name which ones those are, but most people probably have their own thoughts on that. And then in different verticals, you know, and for different use cases, you know, Amazon may be less expensive than some of the other platforms, but they may not have some of the other features that, say, Microsoft or Google are building out. And Google obviously has that deep Kubernetes expertise and came in really strong on kind of the ML side of things. So we see the cloud vendors trying to differentiate in different ways above the core compute infrastructure. And I think that's going to build over time some like workload gravity.
Makes sense. Well, Kurt, I want to throw it to you because you know you have some questions about containers as well.
I do indeed. And mine comes really around the notion of the Linux that we've been talking about. You mentioned the suite of apps and utilities that you're bundling in the environment. And I'm curious, have you standardized on a particular Linux distribution that you use for all of your instances? And, you know, if so, are you using one of the full Linux distros or have you chosen one of the container specific distributions that many people are choosing to build their containers on?
Sure. So the short answer is no. We haven't standardized on one. We do package most of our images and ship Debian because we find that to be very commonly used. But it really depends on the platform that we're supporting and the cloud vendor that we're working with. We also support CentOS. We've built RHEL images. We have our own slim down Linux distro that we use that's Debian based that we use in containers as well because the other offerings that were out there just didn't really work for the applications that we were packaging. So it really depends on, you know, the platform that we're supporting. But Bitnami is pretty Linux distro agnostic down to even, you know, if they're using YAML or APT, it doesn't matter. We can build for both.
Well, it's nice to hear that you allow for that flexibility in your customers right now. Getting back to that whole crystal ball thing, do you think that as we proceed and containers mature as a technology, the trend is going to be toward a single stream of container oriented Linux distributions, or do you think the trend is going to remain one of allowing lots of flexibility depending on exactly which applications are being deployed?
I think the Linux distro is becoming less relevant. I think people care less and less what's going in the container. In a VM world, people really care about which Linux distribution that they're using. And we've experienced that firsthand at Bitnami. And there are even companies like, if you remember RPath, that had built some really cool technology, but it was their own kind of Linux distro and nobody wanted to use it because people still really care what goes in a VM. In a containerized world, that becomes a lot less important. I mean, we very infrequently even get asked what goes into the containers. As long as they run and they have, you know, every library and everything that they need to run and they're as slim down as possible, people don't really care. I mean, now it's more about like reducing the attack surface, right? And just making the containers as small as possible so they consume as few resources possible. So I really think people are caring less and less about the Linux distro. And I think, you know, Red Hat's acquisition of CoreOS is a prime example of that or prime evidence for that. And, you know, may have factored into why they chose to sell to IBM.
So this helps kind of transition a little bit because I think we were talking about Linux and distributions, and I know that you're very closely involved with the Linux Foundation and kind of its goals and its visions, how they're kind of trying to build a sustainable ecosystem around open source. The interesting thing here is kind of relating to Kubernetes and how organizations are taking utilization of it. We've seen things like recently in the news about how Amazon was actually going and forking Elasticsearch and kind of using it in a sense where they were expanding it to do things that normally are charged kind of services for that. And they were kind of almost taking advantage to make money off of the open source side of things. What do you think of that type of things from kind of thinking from the open source perspective of companies and organizations like Amazon doing that?
Sure. And I've been at two conferences where this has been a prime example, as well as, you know, MongoDB's license change and certainly Redis's as well. There's a lot of talk about this right now. I am of the view that a lot of these projects came into being before the cloud was really a thing. And the license models and the business models that they chose didn't really contemplate the certainly not the like the fortitude of the cloud platforms and the popularity of them and how they would kind of change the game. So I think there are some companies that are in a really tough spot. There's an argument that, you know, once you build an open source project and you choose a license, there's kind of an implicit pact that you're making with users that you're going to continue to stick with that license and continue to make software available that way. And I certainly understand that perspective, but I understand the perspective of the companies who are saying, like, look, you know, you need to know what you're signing up for when you're using open source. And if people are signing contributor license agreements and turning over that right to the company has the right to the legal right, certainly to change their model over time. So I understand companies' perspectives on this. I also understand the view that Amazon believes that it's doing the right thing by its customers. They took some bits, again, that were only available in the paid version of Elastic and offered them for free. And they say it's not a fork, but it certainly looks like a fork to me. And again, I see all sides. I don't think ultimately that Amazon did anything wrong. I mean, they do give quite a bit back to open source. And I think they're in their rights to do what's best for the company, their customers. It feels kind of crummy when you have these, you know, smaller companies, though Elastic's, you know, IPO'd, but when you have these smaller companies where it might seem like there's the balance is off, right? Like these major vendors, and Amazon is one example, but there have certainly been others that have tried to kind of subsume or take advantage of open source projects. And it's going to require open source companies to evolve their models over time, is my view. And I do think there will be another license that becomes generally accepted that's still community friendly, but gives people a chance to build businesses around open source software. I could talk for hours about this, so I'll stop it.
One of my favorite topics right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, before we close up, I did want to give one chance to for you to talk a little bit about, because I think it's this super cool, which is the X Factor Ventures. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you got involved?
Yes, I'd love to. And thank you for the opportunity. So X Factor is a fund. It's a seed fund that invests in companies with at least one female founder. And what's really unique about X Factor is all of the investment partners, except for one, which I'll get to in a minute, are women who have founded and scaled their own companies. And everybody but me, in fact, has raised quite a bit of venture capital. Bitnami is almost entirely bootstrapped. But so we have women who have been through this, who have scaled companies, who have got through those really challenging first few years of finding product market fit and building out executive teams and all those things. And we obviously have access to great deal flow because we're out there in the community, you know, working with other women and meeting other founders all the time. And then we feel like we can add really unique value to these founders by helping them, you know, get through those first several years of scaling a business. We do have one token guy, Chip Hazard, who has been in venture capital for, I think, 20 years now. And it was him and a woman named Anna Palmer that kind of got the idea to create the fund. And then it was spun out and it's still supported by Chip's kind of day job, which is Flybridge, which is a VC firm. And our first fund was $2.9 million. We write $100,000 checks out of that. And we've made 27 investments to date across a whole range of different industries. So it's been great for me because I've gotten exposure to businesses that I don't typically spend a lot of time thinking about, given that I live in infrastructure, software, and open source. And we will have a new fund coming online very soon that's bigger, and we'll be writing some bigger checks out of that fund. And we have a bigger number of, you know, female investment partners. So it's been a lot of fun. I think it's a great way to support more women entrepreneurs. And, you know, from a capitalist perspective, it's also a really unique opportunity for us to invest in these founders that are often overlooked, but by pretty much every reporting metric you can get, tend to outperform in the long run.
What was the driving force, like the business prop for Wasabi? What made you guys start that?
So about 4 years ago, I guess it is now, Jeff, my partner, came to me and said he and our chief architect had an idea for a new storage architecture using some new storage technologies that, if it worked, would be far cheaper and faster than anything on the planet. And so I encouraged him to take some of the key people and go off and see if he could make it work. And a couple of years later, he came back and said they had it working. And at that point, I recruited a new CEO for Carbonite and came over and started Wasabi. And the concept is simple. We think cloud storage is just going to be a commodity like electricity or bandwidth. There's no point really in anybody running their own in-house storage farms anymore. And we saw this big migration starting of data from on-prem storage to the cloud. And so we made Wasabi to be exactly plug compatible with Amazon S3, which is the leading product in the market right now. So you can unplug anything that works with Amazon S3 and plug in Wasabi. The difference is Wasabi is 1/5 the price and about 6 times faster. So it's wow. It's pretty disruptive. And we've been on a tear since we launched the company. Really, we just launched in May of 2017. We've raised about $80 million in capital. We now have data centers in Virginia, out on the West Coast, and in Europe. And we've been growing about 25% month over month. And it took us about 5 months to sell our first petabyte of storage. And now we roll in a petabyte of storage every few days. So it's been kind of crazy.
Wow. Now, let's talk a little bit about the technology here. Now, there you said there's some interesting technology that's kind of below the surface here. Right. And we talked a little bit about it, about the whole sequential laying disk data on disks for sequentially. Now, how is this working? Like, is it required that, like, because most OSs don't do it this way. Most kernels don't do it this way. Did you guys have to create a specialized OS, specialized kernel to do this?
Yeah, we don't use Linux or Windows or any other operating system to determine where the bits go on disk. And, you know, I think the 10 years or so that we had at Carbonite dealing with this has given us some unique experience. So our engineers actually know how to get down and control the movement of the heads on the disk drives. And we put the bits on disk where we want them to go, not where Linux or Windows wants them to go. And this allows us to pack more data on disk. It allows us to pack the data on disk in ways that we can read and write large files very, very quickly at probably very close to the theoretical throughput of the drives themselves. We arrange the data striped across multiple servers so that we have a very high degree of redundancy. So we get 11 nines of durability, which is the same as Amazon. And at the same time, we extend the life of the drives. And this is techniques that we learned at Carbonite. And by extending the life of the drives, you can also cut your costs pretty dramatically. And we designed our data centers to be completely lights out. You know, disk drives can fail, but we have so much hot spares sitting around in our data centers that we don't have to visit the data center to do disk replacements and things like that, except once every 3 months or so. Wow. So we've gotten very good at shaving pennies. We're kind of like the Walmart of storage, you know, always the lowest price. That's our motto.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds like lower price doesn't mean that you're actually giving up other things like performance and durability, which is super awesome. That I definitely think that's disruptive. Now, the interesting question here is that it sounds like it's so disruptive. Then why hasn't other storage providers been tried to do this? Like, especially since that you're faster, you're more durable. This obviously should start raising eyebrows for them, right? Why are they not doing this?
Well, you know, there may be, first of all, I mean, companies like Amazon, for people like Amazon, I think it's almost as big an issue with the profit and loss statement as it is the technology. You know, Amazon is charging 2.1 to 2.3 cents per gigabyte per month for S3. They probably have $5 or $6 billion worth of revenue. And I would not want to be the person that walks into the CFO's office and says, you know, gee, I think we ought to cut our price on Amazon S3 by 80%, knock $4 billion off the top and bottom line because some little company in Boston is running annoying advertisements. But it is very difficult technology. I mean, there's no way we could do what we're doing today had we not had 10 years of experience doing this kind of software at Carbonite. And anybody who's starting out today has, you know, at least 2 years of development ahead of them, assuming they're not going to make all the mistakes that we made when we were learning all the tricks that we know how to do at Carbonite. So it's a tough slog. And in addition to that, you're going to have to raise a lot of money now because, you know, we've raised a big war chest and we're out there in the market building a trusted brand. And, you know, when I think of trusted brands, I think of companies like Iron Mountain, for example. That when you think of storing a physical box of paper, you think of Iron Mountain. And when you think about storing digital data, we want you to think Wasabi.
Absolutely. Now, the interesting thing here is the technology you're using is, it sounds like you're using still traditional disks, which allow you to still keep the prices down, also offer, like you said, a little bit more durability. Is that right? You're still using like the traditional, I guess, the public likes to call spin disks?
Yes, we're using spinning disks. We're using SMR, the new shingle magnetic recording drives, because they allow us to pack more data on disk. You know, the bad news about SMR is you can't really just use it with a block-oriented file system like Linux. So you better be prepared to get down there and do what we did, which is really build your own file system.
Right. Now, the interesting thing here is, how does this compare? A lot of these cloud providers they're advertising that, hey, that we're using super high performance SSD drives. You can pay for the higher tier to get that. How does it compare to those? Is it still a comparable? Is it obviously it's cheaper?
Yeah, I mean, a disk is not as fast as an SSD, at least time to first byte. Our time to first byte is probably in the neighborhood of 15 to 25 milliseconds typically. So it's considerably faster than S3. But because we're reading and writing in parallel from a large number of drives, once we get going, if you're reading a large file, excuse me, like a video or something of that nature, we can serve it up really fast. And, you know, we can serve it up at 40, 50 gigs per second. So it's, you know, we can, if you've got a 10 gigabyte pipe going to Wasabi, a gigabit pipe going to Wasabi, we can saturate that no problem.
We hope you enjoyed all the best ofs. We truly had a great year. Thanks to all the co-hosts and thanks to you as well. You are that person that drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to get your enterprise news for each week. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, guest information, and the links to the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll actually get this helpful so download and subscribe links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version, your HD video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices and actually any one of your podcast apps as well. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise news and your IT news. So go ahead and subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, give the gift of Twiat to your friends, your family, your coworkers, because you know what? They'll be super impressed with how much you know about this weekend enterprise news and enterprise news. So go ahead and share it with them as well. Now, ask you to subscribe. Remember, we also do this show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Fridays at live.twit.tv. Come see how the shows run, all the behind the scenes, as well as if you're going to want to jump in and watch the show live, jump into the chat room as well. It's irc.twit.tv. We love the chat room. They give us some great questions and commentary during the show. So definitely jump into the chat room as well. Now, if you can't join live, we know you have a busy week. You have a busy set of jobs. You might want to jump into our Twit community as well. It's a new website out there, twit.community. You can do it now. You actually have some great discussions. We have some new forums out there. All the hosts, including the Twiat Riot, posts out there.
They have some great discussions about technology, the shows. So go ahead and join the TwiWhite as well as the Twit Army out there at twit.community. Also, don't forget you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. They'll get to see all the latest and greatest things that I do, not only at my work at Microsoft, but also the things I do behind the scenes, maybe some of the projects I'm working on, especially some of my gripes I have with some of those companies out there. But also, if you want to see what I do at Microsoft, go head out right now to dev.office.com. There you'll see all the latest and greatest ways to actually customize your office experience and add productivity for your organization. I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit and everyone at Twit for helping us and in supporting us throughout the year. I also want to thank our TDs for this year, Victor, Jeff, and sometimes John, of course. Thank you, everyone, for a fantastic year. We're looking forward to another year here at Twit at Twit. And remember, until next year, I'm Louis Romeresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.